Have you ever noticed how some of the oldest stories, like the really ancient ones, they seem to have like this weird way of telling us something about ourselves?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
So today we're going deep, a deep dive into these books, 1 and 2 Samuel,
okay,
in the Bible. And we're really going to zero in on King David and his reign. We're looking for timeless, you know, those timeless lessons on what it means to be a leader and what it means to leave a legacy behind.
Yeah,
you know,
that's right. You know, we're going to be working with some really rich material here, some insights from a lecture by Dr. Robert Vannoy and Ted Hildebrandt. And they did a fantastic job really laying out the key ideas in these books.
Yeah. And we really want to make this deep dive accessible for you. You know, we want to cut through all the layers of history and figure out, like, what were the intricacies of David's time as king? What made him such an effective leader? But equally important, what were some of his flaws?
Right.
Because he definitely had some.
Right. Yes, he was human. Very human.
Very human, yeah. So we're hoping to just give you those key insights, the stuff that sticks with you, so you can kind of leave all the other details behind.
Yeah. And I think you'll see as we go through this that our sources really illuminate two main themes that kind of weave through the whole narrative of these books. First, the concept of kingship.
Okay.
What did it mean to rule? And then secondly, the idea of a covenant, this binding relationship between God and his people.
Okay, so let's unpack this a little bit.
Yeah.
And so we're at the end of Saul's reign. It's a very dramatic end, right?
Yeah.
Pretty dramatic ending. But the kingdom doesn't just automatically like fall into David's lap, right? He doesn't immediately have control of everything.
No, that's right. He initially only reigns over Judah in Hebron. And that's really where the story picks up in 2 Samuel. The initial chapters really detail how the tribe of Judah recognized David as their king in Hebron. So it was a regional start to his kingship.
It was like a regional thing.
Yeah.
And eventually the other tribes accept him too, right?
Yeah.
But what happens? Like, what's the turning point?
Well, a lot of it had to do with the lack of stable leadership after Saul.
Okay.
Ish-bosheth, Saul's son, he just didn't really do a good job of holding the allegiance of the northern tribes. So you have this power vacuum.
Okay.
And the elders of Israel, they're looking around and they're starting to look more and more to David. They recognize his potential to lead the whole nation.
Right, because he kind of already proved himself as a leader, as a warrior.
Yeah, right.
He's got some experience under his belt. So, okay, so it's not just that they're gradually accepting him, but it sounds like there's a real, like, formal agreement that happens.
Absolutely. 2 Samuel chapter 5 describes a pivotal event, a gathering. The elders of Israel, they come to David in Hebron, and there, in a formal ceremony before the Lord, David enters into a covenant with them. And so it's following this agreement that they anoint him king over all of Israel. So you see, the covenant really underscores this mutual commitment.
Right.
And this is David's official recognition by the entire nation.
It's official. Okay, so now he's got a unified kingdom, right?
Right. Yeah.
And he's thinking, okay, what do I do next? Well, I need to establish a capital, a new capital.
That's right.
And he decides on Zion, which of course later becomes the Temple Mount.
Yes.
But, I mean, this wasn't just a random choice, was it?
No, no, it was very strategic.
And our source really highlights these political advantages to this location.
Absolutely. So first of all, you know, as 2 Samuel tells us, David captures the city from the Jebusites.
Right.
And it was a stronghold. It was heavily fortified. But
right.
But what's so fascinating is the choice of Zion itself. Geographically, it was genius because
right.
It sat right on the border between Judah, which was David's tribe, and Benjamin, which was Saul's tribe. So it didn't belong exclusively to either one, making it neutral, right? A neutral choice for a new seat of government. It wouldn't favor one tribe over another.
That's a good point.
It's brilliant.
Yeah. I mean, keep everybody happy.
Right? Exactly.
You don't want to show any favoritism.
Yeah.
But it wasn't just the political advantage, right? I mean, this was a naturally defensible position.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you look at it, it's surrounded by steep valleys on multiple sides.
Yeah.
Heavily fortified. Zion offered Israel a practically impenetrable national capital.
Fortress.
A fortress, exactly. Yeah. This inherent defensive strength provided a huge long-term security advantage.
Yeah. You're not going to get attacked there very easily.
No.
No. And this wasn't just a decision that affected things then.
Yeah.
Right? this had consequences for way beyond just the political landscape at the time.
Yeah, I mean, the ripple effects are huge. I mean, yeah. Zion became the religious and political nucleus of Israel. Over time, it gains immense spiritual significance in both Judaism and Christianity. And our source points out its impact is felt in subsequent world history. I mean, this site is just brimming with historical and spiritual weight.
Okay, so we've got a unified kingdom.
Right.
We've got a new capital.
Mm-hmm.
And then David makes another really important move. And it's one that really connects to his kingship and this idea of the covenant that we've been talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Bringing the Ark of the Covenant to Jerusalem.
Yes.
This is a huge deal.
This is huge. This event in 2 Samuel chapter 6, it's absolutely key to understanding the whole direction of David's reign. Moving the ark to his new capital was a statement. You know, it was a visible symbol of God's presence and his sovereignty over Israel.
Yeah. And I think for those listening who might not know, maybe we need to kind of back up a little bit and explain what the Ark of the Covenant actually was.
Right. So think of it as the most sacred object in Israel's history. I mean, this was it. It was a relatively small rectangular box made of acacia wood and covered entirely in gold. Roughly 4 feet long, 2.5 feet wide, and 2.5 feet high. It was kept in the most holy place within the tabernacle. So physically, you know, fairly modest in size, but symbolically, I mean, just immense.
Yeah. It wasn't just like a beautifully crafted box, right?
Yeah.
It had this deep meaning, this symbolic meaning.
Absolutely. The space above the ark between the cherubim on the lid, it was considered the focal point of God dwelling among his people.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, in Exodus, God says, "There, above the cover between the two cherubim that are over the ark of the covenant law, I will meet with you and give you all my commands for the Israelites." So it was this point of contact with the divine.
A very tangible link to God's presence, right?
Yes.
And our source mentions that the ark is also described in some really, really powerful ways.
Oh, yeah. Powerful imagery. I mean, the ark is referred to as Yahweh's throne.
Mm-hmm.
In places like 1 Samuel and 2 Samuel, it's the invisible seat of his authority.
Wow.
And then extending that image, it's also called his footstool in 1 Chronicles and Psalm 132.
Really?
Yeah. And inside it contain the tablets of the Ten Commandments.
Wow.
So there you have this connection to God's law. So it really embodies both God's immediate presence and his established law. So bringing it to Zion. Huge.
A huge deal. Yeah, I mean, it's almost like a public declaration, right? Like David and the whole nation are saying, Yahweh, you are our king. You are the one in charge.
Absolutely. It's a public acknowledgement that Yahweh is their true king, divine king. And by establishing the ark in Zion, the city becomes recognized as the place where the Lord has caused his name to dwell.
Right.
Which is, a concept that's foreshadowed in Deuteronomy. So this isn't just about, you know, political consolidation. It's about establishing Jerusalem as the spiritual heart of the nation.
The heart of the nation. Okay. And this idea that Zion is God's dwelling place, it's not just like a one-time thing in the Bible, right? I mean, this is something that keeps coming up again and again.
Oh, yeah, over and over.
Throughout the Old Testament.
I mean, Psalms like 9, 76, 99, 132, they all speak of the Lord reigning, dwelling in Zion. You know, the prophets, Isaiah, Jeremiah, they refer to Zion as the Lord's chosen residence. I mean, this understanding just permeates the whole Old Testament. And it suggests that, you know, Jerusalem will remain a central point until the ultimate renewal of all things.
Wow. Okay, so let's go back to the story. David honors Yahweh by bringing the ark to Zion.
Right.
And then the very next chapter, 2 Samuel 7, the Lord responds.
Mm-hmm.
And it's incredible. He makes this promise to David.
This is a pivotal moment in 1 and 2 Samuel.
A huge promise.
Absolutely.
And the promise is basically an enduring dynasty.
Yeah, God sees something in David and responds by promising him an enduring dynasty. I mean, this is huge.
Yeah. And it's, I mean, this has implications for like the whole Bible, doesn't it?
Oh, it does.
I mean, this really changes things.
It fundamentally reshapes the trajectory because now it narrows the line of the promised deliverer, the one who will ultimately address the problem of sin and evil.
Yeah.
You know, going all the way back to Abraham through the tribe of Judah, now to David's descendants. I mean, it connects directly back to the earliest prophecy in Genesis about the seed of the woman, establishing David as the ancestor through whom the coming Messiah king would arise.
Right. And this is, I mean, this is not just ancient history, right?
No.
This promise connects all the way to Jesus.
Oh, absolutely.
Our source makes that very clear.
the New Testament unequivocally identifies Jesus as the fulfillment of this Davidic covenant. I mean, Matthew's gospel starts by tracing Jesus's lineage all the way back to David and Abraham. The angel Gabriel, speaking to Mary, declares that her son will sit on the throne of his father David. Even in his public ministry, Jesus is often addressed as the son of David. And then Jesus himself, in the book of Revelation, claims to be both the root and the offspring of David.
So this promise echoes throughout history.
It does.
And this enduring promise, it's really explored even more in Psalm 89.
Yes, Psalm 89 is like a reflection, a powerful reflection on this covenant that the Lord made with David back in 2 Samuel 7. It emphasizes the eternal establishment of David's line, the lasting nature of his throne, and God's unwavering love and faithfulness to this agreement. It even touches on, you know, the consequences for disobedience within David's line, but ultimately underscores this unbreakable guarantee of David's dynasty.
It's a huge deal. It's powerful. But I think it's also important to remember that the Bible doesn't shy away from showing us David's flaws.
That's right.
Right. It's not like it's trying to make him out to be some kind of perfect hero.
No, he's presented as a complex figure.
Yeah.
Both greatly used by God and deeply flawed. I mean, you think about the events in 2 Samuel 11 and 12.
Yeah.
Detailing his sin with Bathsheba and then the subsequent murder of Uriah. This is a stark illustration of his very human weaknesses.
It's a huge contrast, isn't it?
Yeah.
The ideal of a covenantal king.
Yes, absolutely.
It's like, this is not what we expect from a king who's supposed to represent God.
Yeah, right. And our source actually draws a connection back to the warnings that are given in 1 Samuel 8.
Okay.
About the potential for kings to abuse their power.
Right.
And you see that here. I mean, in this tragic episode, David acts as if he's above the law.
Yeah.
That he's supposed to uphold, you know, taking what he wants with no regard for justice or the betrayal of Uriah. I mean, this is fundamentally at odds with the expectations placed upon a king who's in covenant with God.
Yeah, it's like he's totally forgotten his responsibility.
Right.
To God, to the people. It's a mess. And God is not happy about this.
No.
At all. I mean, the end of chapter 11, it says that the thing David had done displeased the Lord.
It displeased the Lord.
And that sets the stage for what happens next, which is God sends the prophet Nathan to confront David.
That's right.
And this is interesting, right?
Yeah.
Because Nathan, this is the same prophet who had given David that promise, that amazing promise of an everlasting dynasty.
Exactly. And now his role shifts dramatically from messenger of blessing to messenger of rebuke. I mean, Nathan's task is to bring David face to face with the enormity of his sin and the repercussions it will have, not only for himself, but for his family and his kingdom.
Yeah. And Nathan, I mean, he doesn't pull any punches, does he?
Oh.
He really lays it all out there.
He doesn't hold back. You know, Nathan starts by reminding David of all of God's past grace, anointing him as king, delivering him from his enemies, all these blessings. And then he delivers the indictment.
Yeah.
And he says, you know, why then have you despised the word of the Lord by doing this horrible thing?
Oof.
Yeah. And he names David's sins, the murder of Uriah, the taking of another man's wife.
Right to his face.
Right to his face. And then he lays out the consequences.
Yeah.
It's going to be severe.
Yeah. What does he say is going to happen?
A threefold judgment upon David and his house.
Oh, wow.
First, he says violence will never depart from David's house.
Okay.
Mirroring the violence that David orchestrated against Uriah. Secondly, rebellion will arise from within his own family.
Okay.
And third, his wives will be publicly humiliated. A direct consequence, really, of his secret sin with Bathsheba becoming public knowledge. And the narratives that follow in 2 Samuel and 1 Kings, they actually show the fulfillment of these pronouncements.
Oh, wow. So he's really laying out, I mean, this is bad news.
This is bad news.
Yeah, yeah. So how does David respond to all of this? I mean, he's just been basically, you know, given this huge list of terrible things that are going to happen.
Well, in 2 Samuel 12:13, David simply says, I have sinned against the Lord. And our source points out that the brevity of this confession in the original Hebrew is really striking.
Yeah.
It's just a few words mirroring the directness of Nathan's accusation, you know. But these few words speak volumes about the depth of David's acknowledgement of his guilt.
It's like he's not trying to make excuses.
Not at all.
He's not trying to shift the blame or anything.
No.
He's just saying, yep, I messed up.
Yeah. Ownership.
Yeah. And that's such a contrast, isn't it?
Yeah.
To how Saul often reacted when he did something wrong.
Right. Saul always tried to justify his actions. Like,
yeah, he's always got a reason.
Yeah, looking for excuses, not taking responsibility. David, totally different.
Yeah.
Full, unequivocal acceptance of his guilt before the Lord. And I think Psalm 32 hints at the burden that his unconfessed sin had placed upon him. And it's only through confession that that burden is lifted.
Yeah, and David's understanding of his sin,
yeah,
it goes beyond just the immediate harm that he's caused to Uriah and Bathsheba, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, David recognizes that ultimately his sin was an offense against God himself.
Right.
A violation of God's holiness, you know, his standards. Like Psalm 51 expresses so powerfully, you know, against you, you only have I sinned and done what is evil in your sight. You know, so this was a direct defiance of the word of the Lord, as Nathan put it.
Yeah.
It was trampling on the very covenant that he, as king, was responsible for upholding.
And Psalm 51, it really gives us a glimpse into David's heart at this time.
It does. It's raw.
It's raw. Yeah.
Honest outpouring.
It's very emotional.
Yeah.
You can really feel like his remorse and his regret.
Oh, yeah. He pleads for God's unfailing love, for cleansing from his guilt, for renewal of his spirit. Crucially, he begs not to be cast away from God's presence,
mm-hmm,
not to have the Holy Spirit taken from him. So, you know, you see there his awareness of the spiritual consequences, the devastating spiritual consequences that befell Saul,
right,
when he lost the Spirit.
He's seen that happen firsthand. He knows how bad it can be.
Yeah.
And then Nathan responds, and this is surprising, right?
Yeah.
He says, "The Lord has taken away your sin. You are not going to die." It's forgiveness.
Forgiveness, yeah.
But, you know, our source emphasizes that Nathan's declaration, it's not just rooted in David's repentance.
Right.
Which, of course, is important, right? But it's also rooted in God's prior gracious covenant promise to David.
Absolutely. You know, God's commitment to his own promises is foundational here. It's not like David earned this forgiveness. God had already committed himself to David and his line.
And this, I mean, this whole story, it really highlights that tension between human weakness, human failure, and God's grace.
Yeah, I mean, this narrative it's unsettling in its portrayal of human sinfulness, right?
Yeah.
Even in those that God uses in significant ways. But it's also deeply reassuring in its depiction of God's grace,
yeah,
and his willingness to forgive those who genuinely turn back to him. You know, it's a reminder for us. It's a powerful reminder,
yeah,
that like the Psalms say, we need to place our ultimate trust in the Lord, not in the perfection of human leaders.
Yeah. I mean, we see that all the time today, don't we?
Absolutely.
People putting their trust in other people and leaders who are just as flawed as David was.
Right.
And it never ends well, does it?
No.
It always leads to disappointment.
Yeah. And you know, even though David received forgiveness, he still had to bear the consequences of his choices.
Yeah, that's important, right?
It's a sobering reminder.
It's not like you just get off scot-free.
Right.
Just because you've said, I'm sorry.
Yeah, exactly. As D.R. Davis says, you know, Yahweh forgives the guilt of sin, but inflicts the consequences of sin. He cleanses sin's defilement, but may continue its discipline.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, God remained faithful to his covenant with David,
mm-hmm,
but David still had to live with the repercussions of his sin. Yet even in the midst of those consequences, like Psalm 32 reveals, you know, David found refuge. He experienced God's unfailing love surrounding him.
Hmm. Okay, so let's jump ahead a little bit in the story. In chapter 22 of 2 Samuel, we find this song.
Yes.
A song of David. And our source suggests that it could be titled David's Song in Praise of the Reign of God. It's like this theological reflection on his whole experience.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, this song provides this crucial theological lens.
Okay.
Through which to understand the central themes of 1 and 2 Samuel. And David, as Israel's anointed king, he powerfully reaffirms Yahweh's ultimate authority and sovereignty over all.
And our source points out this connection between David's own understanding of his role and his recognition of God's greater authority.
Yes.
Right. Like, he gets it. He gets that God is the one who's really in charge.
Yeah. There's a verse in the song, verse 29, where David sings, "You, Lord, are my lamp. The Lord turns my darkness into light."
Mm-hmm.
And this actually echoes the sentiment of his warriors who called him the lamp of Israel in 2 Samuel 21.
Wow.
Right. So this suggests that David understood that any light or leadership he possessed was ultimately derived from and dependent upon Yahweh.
He was reflecting God's light.
Yes, he recognized that his authority was derivative. It came from God. And while the song doesn't specifically use the title King for Yahweh, I mean, the whole theme, the overarching theme, is definitely divine sovereignty and power.
Yeah. And this brings up a really important question that our source raises. If God is so committed to obedience, if that's so important to him, then why was Saul ultimately rejected?
Yeah.
And his dynasty ended for his disobedience. But David, who commits this really, really serious sin, is forgiven, and not only forgiven, but promised this enduring kingdom.
It's a good question. And the answer, according to our source, is found within this very song.
Good.
Throughout 2 Samuel 22, particularly in verses 21 through 27, David keeps saying that the Lord rewarded him according to his righteousness and his cleanness in God's sight. He claims to have kept God's ways and to have been blameless before him. He also observes that the Lord shows himself faithful to the faithful, pure to the pure, but hostile to the wicked. You know, rescuing the humble while humbling the proud.
I mean, those are big statements, right?
Yeah.
Especially considering what we know about David.
Yes.
About his sin.
Yes. Bold statements.
How do we make sense of that?
Well, we have to understand the context. You know, David's singing the song after recounting how the Lord delivered him from his enemies, and especially from Saul.
Well,
so the interpretation is that David is reflecting on God's consistent deliverance throughout his life.
Okay.
And he's attributing this deliverance to God's pleasure in what he describes as his general pattern of righteousness and loyalty to the covenant.
So it's not that he's saying he was perfect,
yeah,
right?
Right.
He's not saying he never messed up.
No, not sinless perfection.
It's more about his overall heart attitude and his commitment to following God.
Exactly. It's about the trajectory of his heart, his desire to be faithful to God. And our source suggests that David's actually using these categories of righteousness and wickedness, to contrast himself with Saul.
Okay.
He's saying the Lord rescued the humble, David, who generally sought to follow him but opposed the proud, Saul, who ultimately rejected his commands. So David's claims aren't about individual perfection, but about a fundamental orientation of his life toward covenant faithfulness.
Yeah.
And this is in stark contrast to Saul's pattern of disobedience.
Right. So it's almost like even though they both disobeyed, their hearts were different.
Yes.
Right.
Yes. Their fundamental attitude toward God was different.
And that made all the difference.
Exactly. I mean, despite his failures, you know, at his core, David's heart was oriented toward the Lord.
Mm-hmm.
And when he was confronted with his sin, he repented.
Fully.
Fully. Yeah. Saul, on the other hand, constantly trying to justify his actions, never displaying that same level of genuine contrition.
Yeah. He was never really willing to own up to his mistakes, was he?
No.
It's interesting too, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
That this song of David, it comes right at the end of the main narrative of Samuel.
Yeah.
Almost like the author is really trying to drive home this contrast between Saul and David.
Yeah. By positioning the song there, the author really underscores the difference between Saul, who rejected the Lord and was rejected, and David, who, despite his profound failings, could still legitimately claim this deep loyalty to Yahweh.
It's really powerful. And one more thing I think we should touch on is this word blameless that David uses to describe himself.
Right.
Because it doesn't mean that he's morally perfect, right?
That's right.
It means something different.
It's about covenant faithfulness. You know, as John Calvin said, you know, it's not about a single lapse. It's about a fundamental defection from God. While David stumbled, he never abandoned his pursuit of godliness or the service to which God had called him.
Yeah. It's like he always came back.
Right.
He always wanted to get back on track, you know.
Yeah.
With God. And our source also brings up this point from Gert Quackel, who connects the idea of being blameless before the Lord to the instructions in Deuteronomy.
Yeah, yeah. Quackel argues that, you know, in its original context in Deuteronomy, blameless implies this wholehearted loyalty to Yahweh.
Okay.
And it's demonstrated by listening to his prophets and not engaging in divination or false worship.
Okay.
So here you have a direct contrast, right?
Hmm.
Between David, who consistently sought guidance from the prophets,
mm-hmm.
and Saul, who ultimately turned to a medium and disobeyed Samuel's word.
Right, right. He went his own way.
Yeah.
So basically, David is saying, look, I may have messed up, but my heart is right. I'm trying to follow God's commands. And that's something Saul just couldn't say.
Right.
So then this brings up another question. Did David's obedience, because he was generally obedient, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
Did that earn him God's favor?
Right. Good question.
in the same way that Saul's disobedience led to judgment.
Yeah, our source clarifies that while Saul's disobedience definitely incurred divine judgment, David's imperfect obedience couldn't in and of itself merit God's favor.
Okay.
However, David's obedience was still incredibly significant within the unfolding of God's redemptive plan.
It wasn't that it earned him anything, but it was still important.
Exactly. And you see this in the books of Kings. You know, there are passages in 1 Kings that attribute the enduring promise to David's faithfulness, mm-hmm. his uprightness, his consistent obedience to the Lord's commands, obviously with the exception of the Uriah incident. But this mirrors the promises that were made to Abraham,
right?
Which were also connected to his obedience.
Right, right. I mean, the Bible's full of stories like that, isn't it?
Yeah, but ultimately it wasn't about earning God's favor
right.
through actions, right? You know, God incorporated the obedience of these figures like Abraham and David into the administration of his promises, not as a debt owed, you know, for their good deeds, but as